Today's episode is sponsored by the Intelligent Car Coalition. In 2012, the Intelligent Car Coalition saw that the diverse auto tech and telecommunications industries would converge and transform transportation. So it began bringing people along by talking about the societal benefits of autonomous and connected vehicles. Now it's broadening the conversation to include all of the future of transportation. Automation and connectivity, combined with advances in data, sensor, and electrification technologies, are bringing new choices, and the Intelligent Car Coalition is leading the conversation once again. Join the Intelligent Car Coalition at South by Southwest 2019 when it talks about the benefits we can all gain when we use transportation data to help society. To learn more, visit the Intelligent Car Coalition at intelligentcarcoalition.org. And also, Nguyen Coffee Supply. Nguyen is the first ever Vietnamese-American owned importer, supplier, and roaster sourcing green coffee beans from Vietnam, which are roasted fresh in Brooklyn. Vietnam is the world's largest producer of Robusta coffee beans and second largest producer of coffee overall. I drink it every morning now. It's phenomenal. Fires me up. Nguyen Coffee Supply launched on November 17th of this year. Brand new business. And you can find them at Nguyen Coffee Supply, NGUYENCOFFEESUPPLY.com. Nguyen Coffee Supply. You're running out of time. If you're trying to get in for the holiday season, the deadline to order Nguyen Coffee Supply is December 6th. Two blends, courage and loyalty. I like them both. Courage fires me up. Loyalty makes me feel warm inside. Do it now. Nguyen Coffee Supply. NGUYENCoffeeSupply.com. You won't be disappointed. Enjoy. This episode and this podcast is made possible by donations from listeners like you. Thank you.
This is a huge, distinct sector that in many cases has been either just outright overlooked or oversimplified. More than half of these workers, 5.6 million, are not even drivers.
Welcome to the WashingTech Tech Policy Podcast. We deliver the latest tech policy news and brightest tech policy experts to you.
Wherever you are, so you can stay productive, relevant, and informed in less time.
From Washington, D.C., it's the WashingTech Tech Policy Podcast with Joe Miller.
Facebook's problems keep mounting following a half-hearted meeting with Color of Change. Jim Mattis said Russia interfered in the midterms. And Joe Kane is my guest today. The consequences of Facebook's poor engagement over the years with people of color began to take hold last week. On Tuesday, USA Today's Jessica Gunn reported on a former black Facebook employee, Mark Lucky, who says the company has a deep-seated race problem both internally and on the platform. Lucky wrote an internal blog post on Facebook earlier this month to management and employees that later went public, saying the platform itself actively works against black people. He says that Facebook works against attempts by black users to create safe spaces on Facebook, amplifies some users over others using class-based criteria, which effectively dilutes black voices, and fails to hire a workforce that reflects the demographics of its user base. Color of Change CEO Rashad Robinson met with Sheryl Sandberg on Thursday. Politico reported that it was a victory, but then went on to talk about all of the ways in which it really wasn't. For example, Facebook hasn't committed to release records on its work with Definers Public Affairs to engage in promoting far-right anti-Semitic attacks against George Soros. It was a campaign that also targeted Color of Change. Robinson also told Politico that Sandberg defended Joel Kaplan during the meeting. Apparently, Sandberg, according to Politico's account of the meeting, offered a sincere apology, and Mark Zuckerberg popped his head in. Sandberg did agree to a civil rights audit that Color of Change would conduct and agreed to have a public debate on the results of the audit. But that's really non-negotiable since they have to do something to prevent a boycott, right? Also, a New York Times report out the same day Robinson met with Sandberg suggested that Sandberg directed the communications team in their research of George Soros's financial interests and actually sent an email asking if Soros had, quote, shorted Facebook's stock. A lot of people are just sort of wondering why Sheryl Sandberg, Mark Zuckerberg, and Joel Kaplan should keep their jobs, but would that solve Facebook's race issues? Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said over the weekend during an interview at the Ronald Reagan Public Library that Russian operatives attempted to interfere with the U.S. election. He said the Trump administration's relationship with Russia has deteriorated.
There is no doubt the relationship has worsened. He tried again to muck around in our elections this last month, and we are seeing a continued effort along those lines.
Mattis's remarks came a couple days after Trump canceled his meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the G20 summit amidst Michael Cohen's guilty plea for making misstatements to Congress in the investigation into the Trump administration's business dealings with Russia during the 2016 presidential election. Marriott reported a hack that apparently affected some 500 million of its Starwood guests, exposing personal information, including home addresses, passport numbers, driver's license numbers, names, and other personal details. The New York State Attorney General Barbara Underwood is investigating the breach. The company has known about the breach since early September. Nexstar has announced plans to acquire Tribune Media for $4.1 billion, making it the largest TV station owner in the U.S. The merger would add 42 stations to Nexstar's portfolio, making its total number of stations 216 in 118 markets, just under the FCC's 39% ownership threshold. The deal comes after Sinclair failed in its bid for Tribune earlier this year. CNN reports that President Trump may be considering Makan Delrahim to replace Jeff Sessions as U.S. Attorney General. Currently, Delrahim is the assistant attorney general who sued AT&T to stop its acquisition of Time Warner. He lost. That deal went through. Some are still debating whether the president directed Delrahim to stop the merger. Delrahim denies this, but if he did act on Trump's behest, the attorney general job would be a big reward. You think? The FBI charged 8 individuals last week in an ad fraud scheme. The men faced 13 charges for allegedly scheming to infect 1.7 million computers and drive traffic to counterfeit websites serving up ads. Craig Silverman has a detailed report in BuzzFeed News. The Department of Justice indicted 2 men in connection with an alleged Iranian ransomware plot since 2015 that has caused some $30 million in financial damage to city universities, governments, and hospitals, including the city of Atlanta. Officials say the scheme known as SAMSAM affected more than 200 victims and led to some $6 million in ransom payments. Brian Fung has a story in the Washington Post. Some Google employees have banded together to create a fund that has raised over $200,000 so far to help striking engineers who are opposing Google's work on a censored search engine in China. The project is known as Project Dragonfly, and hundreds of engineers opposed the effort and signed a letter last week to that effect. And you can find links to all of these stories in the show notes and also in our Twitter feed. And our handle is at WashingTech. Stay with us. Today's episode is sponsored by the Intelligent Car Coalition. In 2012, the Intelligent Car Coalition saw that the diverse auto tech and telecommunications industries would converge and transform transportation. So it began bringing people along by talking about the societal benefits of autonomous and connected vehicles. Now it's broadening the conversation to include all of the future of transportation. Automation and connectivity, combined with advances in data, sensor, and electrification technologies, are bringing new choices, and the Intelligent Car Coalition is leading the conversation once again. Join the Intelligent Car Coalition at South by Southwest 2019 when it talks about the benefits we can all gain when we use transportation data to help society. To learn more, visit the Intelligent Car Coalition at intelligentcarcoalition.org. Today's episode is also brought to you by Audible. Listen to books wherever you are. How about Becoming by Michelle Obama? You can download Becoming free by trying audible.com. Sign up for your free audiobook and 30-day trial today at washingtech.com/book. This episode is also made possible by donations from listeners like you. Thank you.
Washing Tech.
My guest today is Joseph Kane, Senior Research Associate and Associate Fellow at the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. Kane's work focuses on a wide array of built environment issues, including transportation and water infrastructure. Within these areas of research, he has explored infrastructure's central economic role across different regions, as well as its relationship to opportunity and resilience. Prior to Brookings, Kane was an economist at the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. He holds a master's in urban and environmental planning from the University of Virginia and a bachelor's in economics and history from the College of William and Mary. Please welcome Joe Kane. Joe Kane, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joe. Great to be here.
So in the piece you co-wrote with Adi Tomer at Brookings that we'll be discussing today and which we've linked to in the show notes, you advocate for policymakers to take a broader look at the automated vehicle sector and that the focus up until now has been sort of too narrow. Give us a thumbnail of what you mean.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're not necessarily advocating for anything here, but we're trying to shed more light and provide a clearer idea of what is going on. As you can imagine, there's just a lot of confusion out there, which is understandable. We're amidst a big digital transition, including new tech, new data, new designs, new platforms like AVs, and no one really knows what's going to happen. You might see a lot of headlines out there that all truck drivers, right, are going to lose their jobs because we're going to see all automated trucks hitting the highways. But really, that's painting in broad strokes, and there's just a lot of, I think, unknowns of what is or isn't going to happen. So what we're focusing on is not so much the shiny new object, right, just the technology itself, but actually looking at the labor market impacts, trying to get greater clarity, greater consistency of who is affected, where they're going to be affected, and what does that mean moving forward? And so it's not just from a sort of a macro scale, right, of just sort of broader industry trends that we're seeing all across the economy at the moment for manufacturing, retail, et cetera, but actually how are individual workers in individual places going to be affected? And so not just, right, who are we going to actually be driving AVs, but who's going to design, manufacture, maintain, and govern these assets? And then how do we begin to design the training programs that equip workers with the skills they need? So those are some of the key points of the research that I'm focusing on at the moment. And I'm working with my colleague, Adi, as you mentioned, on figuring out some of the clearer metrics and policy implications on that front.
And so a lot of the advocacy and research, as you mentioned, has been focused on drivers. But you say there are other occupations that we ought to be focused on?
That's right. So, I mean, intuitively, right, drivers are probably the most obvious example of occupations here. And we've seen this in the news and other reports that have come out. When we think of truck drivers again, or bus drivers, or taxi drivers, right, sort of that whole range of driving occupations. But we can't overlook what I call sort of auto support workers. So in other words, those technicians, mechanics, managers, salespersons, the full gamut of workers, right, that are in auto dealers and in headquarters and manufacturing locations across the country. They're obviously vital when thinking of the technologies that are going to be entering this digital mobility space, as we're calling it. And at the same time, thinking of those transport support workers. So the construction laborers, the highway maintenance workers, the logisticians, the surveyors. So who are going to be the workers that are actually going to maintain our larger built environment, our roadways, these infrastructure facilities that are actually going to be handling these new technologies? And so really the combination between drivers, those auto support workers, and those transport support workers, that's really the universe of different occupations that we're thinking about here. And I think it's important certainly for policymakers to think about that too.
And so how many workers are we talking about here?
So when we add up all these workers, again, the drivers, the auto support workers, and the transport support workers, we come up with at least 9.5 million workers employed, again, in what we're calling the digital mobility sector nationally. And that adds up to 329 different occupations. So just enormous, right? And in the sense that one out of every 20 workers, more than appear in other sizable sectors like finance or insurance or real estate, are actually employed in this space. And so this is a huge, distinct sector that in many cases has been either just outright overlooked or oversimplified. And what I want to emphasize, too, is that more than half of these workers, so half of about 5.6 million out of that 9.5 million, are not even drivers. So the direct labor market impacts are very diffuse, at least based on our current occupational definitions that we have at a national level. And so the reason I say that is that there are many jobs here, right, that have probably even been created yet that we can't even measure. So this 9.5 million worker baseline, right, could very well increase over time. And the point is that there are a lot of workers standing in the path of these technologies, and we just need to do a better job of counting them and then ultimately helping equip them with the skills they need.
And so when we look at the state level, are there particular impacts on the states that we should be aware of? Which states will be most affected by this?
Yeah. So, I mean, first and foremost, every state and every region is going to feel these effects. These workers are everywhere, after all, right? I mean, we have roadways in all our communities. We have warehouses, freight facilities in most of our communities. So these effects are going to be everywhere. But the concentration of employment in this sector will mean that some places will experience a different scale and pace of digitalization in their mobility systems. And so, for example, you think of states in the Midwest and the Southeast are hubs for transportation manufacturing and will likely experience more widespread effects as a result. And just two examples of this, like Michigan and Ohio have more than 700,000 workers alone that are likely to be affected by these technologies. And so they back about 8% of their total state employment. And so nationally, it's about 6%. So it's only slightly higher than what we're seeing nationally. So again, the effects are very widespread. But in all likelihood, as we think of not just, again, not just the drivers, but the manufacturers, the designers, the people who are actually going to be maintaining these technologies, we tend to see those, I think, in many of these traditional transportation and manufacturing hubs.
And so what are you and Adi recommending here in terms of policy solutions?
So to better understand and ultimately address all of this, it's going to require a variety of actions and a variety of actors, particularly at a regional level. So public, civic, and private sectors are going to have to forge those deep lasting partnerships that prepare the country's workforce. It's not going to be just driven by one industry. It's not going to be driven just by one federal actor, but it's really going to require across the board a lot of collaboration, a lot of thinking of what even the challenges are here, because we're still very much in the early days of these technologies, and we're certainly in the early days of becoming with any plans to address those technologies. And so we lay out three sort of core questions as offering a good step for these regional actors in particular, but also these national actors to think about when addressing these issues. So number one is, you know, what are the precise industries and occupations affected? We have provided, again, a baseline here, sort of an overarching view of the full range of workers that could be implicated. But obviously, we need to get more specific. The devil is always in the details, right, when we think of any sort of labor market effects. And so this is no exception. And so we do need to do a more precise job as researchers and as practitioners and policymakers to really define, right, who are the relevant workers and industries here. Two, or what are the skills, knowledge, and training needed by these workers? So once we have this universe of employees and employers identified, we need to do a better job of actually finding out, well, what are the essential tools, technologies, and skill sets that these workers are going to need to actually succeed in their jobs? And these include not only new workers, right, sort of younger workers just starting out, but also existing workers, that a lot of workers here, you imagine auto tech or auto mechanics, they're going to have to be retrained to deal with these technologies. And so there's a lot of movement in thinking of the skill sets here, too. And third, and finally, are what are the workforce development platforms that are ultimately going to get us there? So as we have a better sense of the workers and jobs involved, as we have a better sense of the skills and training involved, then ultimately, right, it's going to require educators, community-based organizations, other partners, right, to actually design the curricula and ultimately the training platforms to help workers better gain a sense of what is the nature of work here and what can actually be done moving forward. So ultimately, we need to move beyond the technological hype to get a better sense of the daily reality that we're going to face.
Well, Joe, thanks for joining me here. And now as we look at these additional jobs, there's even more work, I think, that needs to be done to parse out the demographics within these different segments of the AV workforce to see how different groups are affected.
That's right.
So now let's turn to your icebreaker, your career hack, and your pick for our book this week. Okay, so it's time for this week's icebreaker, Joe. The rules are simple. I spin the wheel. It was a random question. I ask it and you answer. Sound good?
Sounds good.
All right, so let's see what we come up with here. What is your favorite quote and why?
Well, you know, being a planner, I've got to go with a Jane Jacobs quote. And so this one resonates for me and a lot of the work I do. It's, you know, cities have the capability of providing something for everybody only because and only when they are created by everybody. And so, you know, when I think about that, and it relates not only to what we've been talking about in terms of AVs, but if we're ultimately not looking at some of these challenges from the perspective, right, of not just employers, not just employees, but the full range, right, of residents and other people that are affected by these changes, we're not really doing our job, or I'm not doing my job, right, as a researcher. And so in as much as I can reflect on what are the needs and realities that we're all facing, right, that we're all going to be dealing with, particularly when we think of a lot of urban issues, that's important. And so in that respect, you know, Jane Jacobs has a bunch of other quotes that are good here too, but this one particularly stands out for me.
So how do you stay productive and successful, Joe? What are some of your tactics for getting your work done?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what helps me a lot is looking beyond just myself and just my work. And I'm lucky because my focus on cities usually gives me the chance to meet and hear about some of the truly awesome work that's happening all around the country and all the world. And so I certainly don't have all the answers around, for example, we talk about an AV workforce, but I like to think I know how to ask some of the right questions. And so learning from a bunch of incredibly passionate leaders, organizations, gives me a lot to reflect on, you know, and I hope keeps my work fresh and interesting.
And what are you reading and watching these days?
Well, I haven't had much time to watch too many shows.
I know the feeling.
I've been busy with all this work, but one book that I've been reading that's kind of interesting and relevant to some of the issues happening right now, and at least the sort of urban economic space, is Why the Garden Club Couldn't Save Youngstown by Sean Safford. And so it looks specifically at how Youngstown, Ohio, compares to Allentown, Pennsylvania, but really looks at this idea of what I call sort of regional divergence, right? That you have winners and losers among different cities, that particularly following HQ2, right? The announcement here in DC and then in New York as well as additional location, that you have some places that seem to be winning and doing quite well when it comes to their economic development. And then you have places that are just increasingly losing jobs, losing people, losing investment. And so this book's somewhat interesting and it tries to peel back some layers on answering that question. And so I definitely recommend it.
And we've linked to that as well in the show notes. Well, thanks again, Joe, for joining me. What are some takeaways you'd like to leave with us and where can we find you?
Yeah, I'd love to just keep the conversation going. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk today and feel free. Anyone should feel free to shoot me an email, jkane@brookings.edu. Or if you want to read some of the many, many articles I've done. You can also find
that. I saw that. Yeah, you do have a lot of articles. I was trying to find the one you did recently, and there were like 12 since then.
Well, that's right. So I don't have time to watch TV.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Listen, I know how it feels. We've been listening to Joseph Kane, Senior Research Associate and Associate Fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings. Joe, thanks for joining me.
Thanks again, Joe.
That concludes episode 165 of the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what we do, we'd love to hear from you. Please take a moment, head over to Apple Podcasts, give it a review. It helps others know what they can expect from the show and really helps us out. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you back here next week. Take care.